This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We've got this week's episode of The Spark and Our Island Universe coming up later in the half hour, and we'll get to Jordy Yeager's story on food insecurity in Virginia, the first in a series. Our first story today is out of Charlottesville, where, with college back in session, many UVA students are working part-time jobs on campus to help pay the bills, you know, waiting tables, running registers, maybe reshelving books at the university library. But one UVA student has followed a different path. WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente went to meet her.
I've been standing here at this door knocking for a couple of minutes now. In a moment, I'll find out that the 19-year-old I'm here to visit has been playing her music too loud to hear me.
Hi.
Hi, Lele. How are you?
Good.
In that way, and in many others, she's a pretty typical second-year college student.
I like to go out with my friends.
I woke up at like 10:30.
I like to watch Netflix.
I don't know what I want to do when I graduate yet. I have no idea.
But in one important way, she's unique.
I currently make jewelry.
Lele Secor doesn't just make jewelry. She sells jewelry. 12,000 pieces so far. She's at UVA now, but her story began in upstate New York a few years back. She was 16, and like high school kids all over the U.S., she was on the hunt for her first summer job. She applied at local shops, restaurants, the grocery store.
Didn't hear back from any of them, except that I did get a rejection letter from the grocery store.
But rather than give up, Lele got crafty. She figured, if nobody's going to hire me, I'll make my own job. She'd been a fan of the Etsy website for years, and she enjoyed making friendship bracelets, so, you know, why not try selling those? But that didn't really work.
I didn't really get any responses.
So Lele did what many great entrepreneurs will eventually do. She pivoted. She taught herself to make something new from videos on YouTube.
Wire-wrapped jewelry and rings.
Within a week of posting her first ring on Etsy, she had her first sale.
And I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting.
That was almost 3 years ago, and Lele has been receiving a steady stream of orders ever since. This time of year, she receives 10 to 12 a day, but her sales spike during the holiday season, which coincidentally is right around finals.
I was actually up until 2 in the morning before my last final making jewelry, so it was really stressful.
For the most part, though, Lele says she enjoys the job. On average, she spends about 6 hours a week fulfilling orders, and she does most of her work right here at a tiny white desk in a sunny corner of the bedroom she shares with a roommate.
All my supplies are in the drawer, so when I'm ready to go, I can just open the drawer, and everything's all here ready for me.
Today, Lele has a stack of about 30 envelopes ready to ship, and another 15 that are addressed, but waiting to be filled with jewelry she hasn't made yet.
This size pile actually isn't that bad. When I can hold the envelopes, all the envelopes in one hand, that's a good sign, because that means I'm almost done. So I can just make something real quick here.
What are you going to make?
I make a ring. I just cut a piece of wire.
In addition to making the jewelry, Lele handles all of the product design, modeling, photography, website development, marketing, social media, customer relationships, shipping, finances. She does it all.
I have a pretty good system now, but I guess when I list out all of the things that I have to do, it sounds kind of overwhelming, but it hasn't been that bad.
Boundless energy is certainly one asset that a 19-year-old brings to running a business. Another? Being comfortable with the constant attention that running a 24-hour online shop requires. In fact, every time Lele makes a sale, she receives notification through an Etsy app on her phone.
People are buying things at all hours of the night, so, you know, I could be out with my friends and, oh, I made a sale. So it's really convenient.
Does the Etsy app on your phone make a noise when you get an order?
I think the default noise is like a cha-ching sound, but I turn that off because, you know, I don't really want to be cha-chinging when I'm out in public. So I have it on silent.
Her phone may not be cha-chinging, but her bank account certainly is. Since Lele launched her Etsy shop 3 years ago, she's earned, are you ready for this? Over $100,000. But lest you think she's getting rich, almost all of the money she's made has gone towards her college expenses, which for her as an out-of-state student at UVA, total about $56,000 a year.
Yeah, wish I was in state, but, you know, it's okay.
Still, that $100,000 number has attracted a lot of attention. Lele's story has been featured on the Huffington Post, Yahoo News, and the websites of the Washington Post and 17 Magazine, among others. But the coverage she was most tickled by? entrepreneur.com.
It's one of my favorite websites. I love reading all their articles and stuff. So then when I got featured on there, it was like, finally, like, it was great. I love that website. I hammer it because it makes the wire less malleable.
And you're done.
Yep.
That's it. That seriously took like 2 minutes.
When I'm like in the zone, I can get like about 20 or 30 orders done in an hour.
At the rate she's going, Lele thinks she may be able to graduate debt-free from UVA. But when she does, she's not sure what she'll do next. Maybe continue running her Etsy shop. It's called Designed by Lele, by the way. Or take her chance at some other entrepreneurial adventure.
Being an entrepreneur is great because it's like, you know, you get to put all your creativity and all your energy into something, and I think it's something that's really rewarding.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
Here's another story from the Charlottesville area, but with a much different focus. According to Feeding America, an average of about 10% of Virginia residents in the WMRA region are food insecure, meaning they are without reliable access to a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food. And that percentage climbs in our cities, with about 15% of urban residents classified as food insecure. Overall, more than 1 in 10 people from the WMRA area don't know where their next meal is coming from. But who are these people, and who is trying to help them? In the coming weeks of October, WMRA will explore the experiences of Virginians struggling with food insecurity, from children to the elderly, from the able-bodied poor to those who are disabled and are homebound, and the people and organizations trying to help, and the challenges those organizations face in raising community support for their efforts. In our first report, WMRA's Jordy Yeager talks with some of those affected by food insecurity and how several organizations are fighting to end it.
It's Tuesday night, and the Loaves and Fishes food pantry behind Albemarle High School is teeming with people. Old and young, white and black, more than 50 cars are parked out in the lot. About 24 people are in the waiting room. It's like this 4 days every week. They're here, many with their families, for a free monthly cart of groceries.
Well, we have six all together. See, these are his grandchildren, and this is my granddaughter, and we're all one family. Yeah, so that's why we come to the food bank.
That's Deborah Vaughn, a 50-year-old nurse who was placed on disability after having one of her lungs removed. She currently has a family of 10 living in her Charlottesville home. Six of them are under 9 years old.
This is not fun to carry you through a whole month, but they give like a good supply of food and snacks and stuff like that, you know. And so, we use it. We have six children house, you know.
Located in an old UPS warehouse just outside of Charlottesville, Loaves and Fishes serves about 1,700 families, or roughly 6,000 individuals, each month. The food pantry is one of more than 200 partner agencies that the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank provides with food throughout 25 counties and 9 cities in central and western Virginia, from Winchester down to Lynchburg. In total, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank provides more than 118,000 people with food each month. Just to give some perspective, that's the same as if you fed every resident in Harrisonburg, Charlottesville, and Stanton once a month.
We provided the food for about almost 21 million meals last year. And when you think about that much volume and you think about how many people, it's like preparing for 4,000 people to come to dinner tonight and tomorrow night, the next night, and every night for a year.
Michael McKee is the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank.
Think about the impact of that. It's not just about someone goes to bed hungry. It means someone's got to feed their kid. And if they have to buy that food, they go out without themselves, but they may also not have enough money to buy medication. They may not have enough money to put gas in the car to get to work or pay the rent, which could lead to homelessness. We find that 2/3 of the people we serve are choosing between paying rent and buying groceries. 1/3 or more are choosing between transportation and food. And this problem isn't getting better simply because for many of us the economy looks like it's getting better. In fact, for a lot of people it's getting worse.
McKee is describing what's commonly called food insecurity, or what the USDA defines as consistent access to adequate food that is limited by a lack of money and other resources. The effects of food insecurity are pretty widespread. from higher rates of diabetes and heart disease to increased school dropout rates. And in Virginia, like most states, the number of food insecure people continues to rise. 9 years ago, in 2006, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank served 58,000 people a month. Since then, it's more than doubled.
At the end of the day, you say, okay, well, where did these extra 59 or 60,000 people come from? Well, they were working before the recession hit. Many of them are still working, but at a far lower wage. They're underemployed. And then, of course, some still are unemployed.
When we think of people going hungry, most of us probably think of the homeless at soup kitchens. But all of the clients I met at Loaves and Fishes told me that they not only had homes, but that at least one person in their household was currently working. Likely, we interact with these folks every day. They're restaurant workers, cashiers, janitors.
When you come and see what, you know, the clients that come through here, they are all walks of life, they are all ages, they are all demographics. We've got one-person households, we've got, you know, large families, we've got medium-sized families, we've got every, you know, all different ethnic kind of groups.
That's Loaves and Fishes Executive Director Margaret McNett Burris. She says that the food pantry's numbers have also doubled over the last 3 years. Though the growth has slowed down a little bit this year, she says, it gives her hope that perhaps the worst of the economic downturn is over, and now folks can start rebuilding their lives again. She knows just how big a part Loaves and Fishes plays in allowing people to do exactly that.
And so, you know, I have had clients say to us, you know, we don't know what we would be doing if you guys weren't here.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, you know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Last week on The Spark, Trudy Hale talked about how she resurrected a semi-derelict antebellum house in Nelson County and turned it into The Porches, a writer's retreat on the James River. This week, she talks about how she, his editor-in-chief, along with a group of determined, word-loving volunteers, keep alive a Charlottesville-based example of perhaps that most endangered of journalistic species, the literary magazine. So gather around the radio, folks, and listen to the story of Streetlight.
I came on to Streetlight on the last hard copy issue as the fiction editor, and it was Literary Arts Journal out of the Writing Center. And LexisNexis was the publisher, donated publishing. And then in 2008, LexisNexis was bought by another company, and also it was the crash. So we lost our publisher. And so all of us are writers and lovers of language and words, and but none of us are fundraisers. And also it was the crash, and
there weren't many funds to be raised.
We felt very, you know, how do we go around asking for money when everyone is really worried about the country's economy? So we went on a little hiatus. We had to, because the Writing Center had a board, and I wasn't privy to a lot of the politics, but we were able to wrestle our nonprofit status. So then we became totally independent from the Writing Center, the Charlottesville Writing Center. And that was such a valuable status to be nonprofit. So even when we lost our publisher, we all agreed that we wanted to just hibernate and try to pull our forces together and figure out our next step. And so there was a couple of years where we were not online, and we hadn't even considered going online. We were still thinking to find a publisher.
Were you just dark?
We were just dark.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And we moved. I said, well, we have to have an address. So everybody decided it'd be my address in Norwood. I said, okay. And then the opportunity for an online magazine came into being, and it was very exciting. And
what do you mean the opportunity for an online magazine?
Well, we didn't have any money. And so, and all of us are volunteers and lead busy lives. And so then there was a writer who came to the porches, and she was very tech savvy. So I thought, well, let's do a trade. I said, okay, I'll trade you some residency at the porches if you can help Streetlight get online.
Do you want to name a name?
Chelsea Evenstar.
Right.
In fact, her website is, there's a link to her website on our website. Indie Publishing, I think it's called.
I'll give you this for that, that for this. We'll have it made with barter.
So she got us on WordPress. So there was a lot of discussion about our look, and we really wanted to have it, Streetlight, be an aesthetic experience as well as a literary experience in the terms of, I mean, so many sites, because they're trying to catch your attention, we felt like they were cluttered, and we wanted to keep true to this clean, simple line, engaging line, but not have a lot of clutter and noise. And so we're very, very proud. We're very proud of the site. And then we had our co-poetry editor, Lisa Ryan. She and her husband helped design this really cool, the street light, where it light, you know, there's a light behind it.
We can talk about the street lights.
So it's gone through many stages in terms of shaping the look, selecting the content and the art. Elizabeth Mead Howard is a wonderful art editor, and the interviews that are done with the artists, so that you're not just seeing their work, you're hearing how the inspiration comes to them, what are the obstacles or the challenges in bringing this concept of their what's in their imagination to fruition. The genres we have are memoir, essay. Susan Shafersek is the editor. Poetry is Sharon Leiter and Lisa Ryan. And fiction, we've just have a new fiction editor, wonderful writer, Erica Raskin. Is that everybody? Yeah, and then we have a blog. So I kind of wrestle and herd and beat the bushes for bloggers. That's my job. Okay, what do I get out of it? I'm in the writing world when I'm in it. I'm talking the writing talk. I love to talk about materials and the stories and the language and all those things writers love to chew and ingest. I mean, it's you know, how structure affects meaning, and I mean, it's a great group of people. We have writers submitting from all over the country now, and that was one of the things we had to discuss in terms of sort of our mission uh-huh. statement, because we were so, the print copy was focusing on the area's writers mm-hmm. and promoting Virginia writers and Charlottesville, but once you go out there, you're out in the world. The internet is a different animal. And we're trying out new avenues. We just had our first poetry contest and competition. And those winners, first, second, third place, and three honorable mentions, will be appearing in the fall issue, which is going to be published October 5th. There is an expectation that things are changing all the time. And that's when we began the blog. We would like to have more interactive kinds of forums and more competitions, and I mean, it's that kind of thing where about the readership, how do you keep people coming back to look at the journal? I mean, you have an issue that's quarterly, the fall, winter, spring, summer. So once people have read the material, unless they go and just read the blogs, there is that question and challenge. How do you keep them checking in and seeing what's going on? And I don't know that we've solved that.
You
I think
for
that's,
suggestions?
Absolutely, you got some.
You'll find some pictures and links relating to Streetlight Magazine on the Spark page at WMRA.org. And if you missed last week's part one of my conversation with Trudy Hale, you'll find a link to that as well.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. On July 14, 2015, the world awaited confirmation that NASA's New Horizons survived its closest approach to Pluto, now labeled a dwarf planet and located in the Kuiper Belt of our solar system. This rendezvous with Pluto was momentous for several reasons. For one, it closes the chapter on our reconnaissance tour of our solar system that first started with the Mariner program in the early 1960s. Now in 2015, our species has sent robotic sentinels that have visited all eight major planets, two dwarf planets, and even a comet. And the pictures of Pluto showed a surface that no one was expecting. The images returned show mounds made of ice nearly 11,000 feet high, areas on the surface devoid of craters, suggesting an age much younger than anticipated. Pluto's crust is now thought to be made of water ice rather than frozen nitrogen. Best of all, we are literally seeing the tip of the iceberg. Over 95% of the data from that flyby is still on board the spacecraft, awaiting downlink to Earth. Getting all that data will take almost 16 months. So expect many more images and many more discoveries in the months ahead. New Horizons is a gift that will keep on giving, providing us with more clues about how our solar system formed some 5 billion years ago. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. You too can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.